Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A major shift seems to be taking place in journalism today, not only in the way events are being reported, but also in who is doing the reporting and the means being used to distribute the information. Increasingly, news is being reported by citizen journalists. Their delivery system is not a paper on the front lawn or news over the radio, but by cell phones and iPads and through social media. The Arab Spring came to us to a very large degree this way, bringing us revolution in real time and supplementing and in many cases scooping professional journalists on the ground. There are both critics and proponents of this new journalism. Neither can ignore it. National Public Radio is no exception. Andy Carvin is NPR's senior strategist for social media. He's been right in the thick of it, as detailed in his new book, Distant Witness, Social Media, the Arab Spring, and a Journalism Revolution. He joins us by phone from NPR in Washington. Andy, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin by asking you to give me your job description, senior strategist for social media. That's kind of a new one.
It is kind of a new one, but that's because the role I played didn't really exist in newsrooms as recently as 5-10 years ago. My work generally could probably be described better as a journalistic test pilot, in which I experiment with new techniques and tools to see how NPR can interact with the public to improve the quality and diversity of our journalism. And so the job title is in some ways intentionally vague, because my work isn't the sort of thing that would typically work under an editor or as a producer or, you know, as a reporter who's expected to file X number of stories per week. Social media is still a fairly new phenomenon, especially in terms of how we integrate it into our news gathering, into our news coverage. And so by having a somewhat vague title, it's allowed me to be more flexible and go down the rabbit hole wherever it may lead.
You also call yourself a facilitator. Elaborate on that, if you would.
Well, a lot of what I end up doing online is trying to get the public to engage with each other as well as to engage my sources directly to get a more direct sense of what's happening on the ground. You know, typically, if you look at broadcast journalism, you have a group of people behind the scenes who are working as producers, editors, researchers, what have you, to create a story that then gets passed on to the public either through packaged stories or, you know, web articles or an on-air host discussing something. In many ways, what I'm doing is similar to that, except I don't have staff supporting me. I have my Twitter followers working with me as translators and researchers, covering a whole range of specialties and interests. And so by working together with them, we're able to piece together certain types of stories in real time that are sometimes harder to do in a traditional newsroom, and at the same time serves essentially as a media literacy experience for them, so they become more informed, smarter consumers and creators of media.
What about your own credentials as a journalist?
I have never worked professionally as a journalist before. The closest I come to it is when I was in college, I helped found a music magazine largely so we could get tickets to free concerts in the greater Chicago area. My background prior to coming to NPR was essentially as an internet policy wonk and online community organizer. I used to run a nonprofit social network called the Digital Divide Network, which worked with groups around the world, businesses, nonprofit organizations, governments and the like, to bring internet access and internet literacy to parts of the globe that didn't have it. And so in my prior role before coming to NPR, I was able to learn how to use a variety of online tools to collaborate with the public, to solve problems, answer questions, and the like. And so I originally came to NPR about 6.5 years ago to see if any of those same techniques could be applied to strengthening NPR's journalism.
Do you think in any sense that you are at any kind of a disadvantage for not having a journalistic background?
Well, one could argue that there are certain things that you can only learn by, you know, being a cub reporter at some point and doing that type of shoe leather journalism. And certainly, I think for people who want to practice certain styles of journalism, that's absolutely a requirement. But my interest has always been trying to push the envelope and experiment with new forms of storytelling. And I specifically use the word storytelling because not everything I do would necessarily be considered journalism. A lot of what I'm doing, you could almost describe as a type of real-time oral history. I've had some people describe what I do as a form of information DJing, which I think is a fascinating concept because it suggests that I'm receiving all these samples and bits of information in real time and working to spin them out back to the public in a way that they can consume, that's informative and interesting and exciting to them.
You may be familiar with the Pew State of the News survey that came out this week. Just to refresh our audience's memory, newspaper newsrooms are down 30%, and local TV, sports, weather, and traffic account for 40% of the newscast. The number of consumers of traditional news media is down 31%. It would seem to me that the door is wide open at this juncture for the kind of thing that you're doing. Feel the same way?
Yeah, I think the door is wide open, not only for non-traditional news startups that are being developed, but I think for traditional mainstream media as well. I think there are so many opportunities for news organizations, large and small, to strengthen their relationships with the public. I mean, if you think just at public radio, for example, we have such a loyal, impassioned audience because they literally make investments in our success. They feel they have a vested interest in our success. And so what I'm really interested in doing is figuring out new ways to not only tap into their pocketbooks, which stations already do very, very well, but to tap into their skill sets, to their knowledge base, their experiences. And so the type of reporting we can do can be stronger and more diverse than ever.
Do you find in any sense that there is a dividing line between older and younger audience with regard to acceptance of this new journalism?
You know, I don't think the dividing line is generational because I know too many people who are recently out of graduate school in their 20s who are skeptical of my methods, and I know plenty of people who are approaching their retirement years who are enthusiastic about it. I think the divide tends to exist based on how comfortable a person is about being open in terms of how journalism is produced, because you know some people have a more traditional mindset and believe that nothing should be shared publicly until you have all the facts straight and everything is perfectly aligned, whereas the way I look at it is there are already things circulating on the Internet, many of which are not true and need to be addressed publicly so we can debunk what we can and verify what we can. And so by being more transparent about what we know and what we do know, I feel like I'm able to verify and authenticate things in new ways. And understandably, there are a number of people who aren't comfortable with those methods.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more in detail about that. I'm sure we'll get some calls on it a little bit later as well. But, you know, I'm struck, I'm of such an age that I remember very well the reportage during the Vietnam War, the so-called living room war, but everything we got at that time was at least 24 hours old because it was filmed and the film had to be processed and then it had to be gotten back to the States where the networks could put it on the air. What a light years change we've gone through.
Right. You know, what's extraordinary about geopolitical conflicts that have taken place over the last few years is not only does social media give news organizations the chance to receive information and footage directly from eyewitnesses on the ground in real time, it also gives the public a chance to essentially do an end run around mainstream media and engage these sources and eyewitnesses directly. And so for the first time ever, an average person who has access to the Internet, they can talk to protesters, they can talk to revolutionaries or rebels if they choose to. They can reach out and talk to people directly on the ground. And it's a type of experience that we couldn't have dreamed of as recently as 10 years ago.
You know, your book focuses obviously on the turmoil during the Arab Spring. Give us some sense, Andy, of how you got started in all of this.
Well, because my primary role at NPR was to experiment with new tools, I spent a lot of time on Twitter in the years prior to that. We used Twitter quite aggressively during the 2008 presidential campaign to have people help us fact-check presidential debates and the like. We would use Twitter and Facebook and other tools during real-time coverage of natural disasters like the Haiti earthquake. So I had already begun developing a rapport with followers on Twitter to help me with certain types of stories. But because of the prior work I did on internet access issues around the world, I had also gotten to know a number of North African bloggers about 5, 6 years ago, so just a little before I started working at NPR. And so when some of those same people in Tunisia began tweeting about protests that were spreading across the country, it caught my attention. You know, I had already established loose relationships with some of these people. And so I began to apply some of the techniques I was using for other NPR projects to what was happening in Tunisia. And before we know it, 4 weeks into the protests, their president resigns, and then Egyptians start organizing their own protests, and then it spreads to half a dozen other countries around the world. And so what essentially began as a little bit of curiosity on my part became a full-time job.
And how did NPR utilize the kind of information you could provide?
Well, it took us a little while to get our rhythm right, but ultimately what we'd end up doing is I developed relationships with our breaking news team. So for example, the people who run a breaking news blog, I would routinely pass on information to them and help curate what's been fact-checked and what hasn't been fact-checked. I also developed stronger relationships with people involved at our foreign desk. So while all of this was going on, we had people that were in Egypt or going to Libya or Syria and the like. And so I ended up serving as an ad hoc social media producer for them to strengthen what they were doing. And so ultimately, NPR's coverage became very complementary. So on the one hand, we had people on the ground doing traditional shoe leather journalism while I was able to tap into the virtual streams to cover these topics from a different angle.
Was there any sense of resentment or competition that developed amongst those whose boots are on the ground and what you were doing?
None whatsoever. At least I never got caught wind of any of it. I think it's because everyone recognized early on that what I was doing was new. It didn't interfere with anyone else's coverage, and in fact, it sometimes enhanced it because I was able to share my information with them, and they would do the same for me. So, for example, if you look at the coverage NPR has been doing for Syria with Deb Amos and Kelly McEvery's going in and out of the country, over the last couple of years, they've become really exceptional in terms of how to monitor social media and authenticate content through it. And so that was a process that we all developed together. So while they'd be on the ground going in and out of Syria, I would focus on the social side of things, and over time they learned how to do both. So I think it's been a win-win.
I want to talk more about authenticating material in just a moment, but we have to take our first break. Andy Carvin, he is NPR's social media strategist and author of Distant Witness, Social Media, the Arab Spring, and a Journalism Revolution. And by the way, Andy's going to be in St. Louis tomorrow evening for an event right here at the UMSL at Grand Center Community Room. It's part of St. Louis Public Radio's Kitchen Sink series. It's going to be happening at 7 o'clock. We have more information on our website, but if you'd like to meet Andy personally and talk more about what we're talking about today, come on by 7 o'clock right here on Olive and Grand Center. We'll be back in just a moment with Andy Carvin. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Andy Carvin. He's NPR's social media strategist and the author of Distant Witness, Social Media, the Arab Spring, and a Journalism Revolution. And we invite your calls if you'd like to give us your take on citizen journalism and the use of social media. We'd like to hear from you. 382-8255, that's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We will, of course, take a tweet at STL on Air, and you can reach us through Facebook. Back to the question, Andy, of authentication. The World Summit on Information Technology was held recently in Paris and issued a report, and I'm going to read just quickly from it. The report notes that in the digital environment, when the source of information is often unknown, it becomes more difficult to determine credibility. Is the source supporting a hidden point of view? Is the blogger offering to promote products for a fee? Does the ethical culture transfer to the online environment? That is, the critics are pointing to things like that every day.
Well, that's been a part of journalism as long as journalism has existed. Whenever you try to find sources on certain issues that are politically charged, of course they're going to have an agenda. Of course they're going to have certain interests in mind. And so in some ways I find a lot of that statement self-evident. And so when working on any type of story, you have to take into account why people might be sharing certain bits of information with you. And so on the one hand, when you're dealing with protesters in a place like Tahrir Square in Cairo, you know that they're there because they want to overthrow the government or they want to radically change it. And so you have to take that into account when engaging them. But at the same time, a number of these people, while having strong political perspectives, also happen to be fairly good at capturing footage, whether they're photographers or recording audio or video. And when you gain access to that type of primary source material, then you can start going through the process of scrutinizing it. And there are a variety of techniques you can use for authenticating content. So it's just not it's not only people going out there making claims that, oh, there are a million people here in Tahrir Square, because that may or may not be true. When you have lots of people who are engaging from on the ground rather than just one person, you can piece together the truth by cross-referencing all of that information and sorting through it.
You know, what comes to my mind as we're chatting about this was a situation in Iran a couple of years ago. There were some demonstrations, and some video was making its way out, quite a bit of it, as a matter of fact. And at some point, it was determined that the video that we were seeing had actually been shot during other demonstrations a couple of years before that. And it took quite a while before this was determined. How do you verify? I mean, how do you make sure that you're not being having the wool pulled over your eyes like this?
Well, I think we've learned a lot of techniques since then. So, for example, when I first received videos of protests in Libya before anyone had reporters in the country, I had my Twitter followers listen to what was being said and detecting local accents, because Arabic is not a monolithic language. People speak it in a wide range of dialects across the region, and it's not hard, if you speak the language fluently, to pick up on where a person is from. So people would listen to what's being said. They would look for landmarks in the background to see if we could identify anything and mark it on a Google Earth or Google Maps to find corresponding images of it. If there were things that we know had changed in that area, like had a statue been torn down over the last year, can you see that statue in the background? Does the weather correspond for that particular day? If there are shadows and the lights in a certain position, does it match the time stamp for when it was supposedly filmed? And so if you put a bit of effort into it, you can often figure out how authentic the content is. Now, it raises all sorts of other questions of whether or not it's representative of what's going on there, but it has become a lot easier to put footage in context.
But when you're not dealing with footage, when you're dealing with the written word, if you will, isn't it possible that that process can be usurped by people who have their own particular agenda, regardless of where they are?
That's already what's happening. Everyone who's on Twitter, who's engaged in these events, they have their own agendas, and in some cases engage in propaganda, which is why I think it's really important in the news business to educate the public on the tricks that people use to misinform them or to sway them. And so part of what I do is, in many ways, I see my Twitter account as this ongoing media literacy class, because I'm able to share what people are saying and invite the public to help me dissect it, as well as finding other sources on the ground who might verify or contradict what's being said. And so, of course, people with agendas are going to continue doing what they've always done, but at least now we can engage in a back-and-forth conversation with others online to put all of this in context and, in many cases, debunk it.
How do you teach this particular brand of media literacy?
Well, I think people learn it simply by engaging with me online. So I'll see people tweeting in all capital letters, confirmed, blah, 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 has happened in Syria. And then I'll reply to them and I'll say, how do you know it's confirmed? And they'll say, well, my brother just talked to his sister-in-law who's there, and we're here in the U.S. I then explain to them that does not make it confirmed. That means one indirect source has told them something. And so, it's not unusual to see people essentially parroting what they think journalists do by throwing out phrases such as confirmed or breaking news, and et cetera. And so by being able to respond to these folks and have them really parse what they've just said, it often helps them understand that, they may actually be hurting the flow of information more than helping it. And so by working with these people so they become better communicators of information, it improves the overall quality of information that's coming out of those particular regions.
We're starting to get phone calls, not unexpectedly. Let's bring the audience into the conversation. And Andy Carvin, we'll begin with Jim calling from St. Louis. Jim, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. This is pretty relevant to what you guys have been talking about. I'm a big fan of the Internet. I spend most of my professional and personal life on the Internet. And I do I get most of my news from the Internet. But what I'm starting to see is proliferation of what I like to call Internet autism, where we're just everybody's getting overloaded with different sources, different opinions, and what we're needing is more people like your guest who are going out there and doing the fact-checking, doing the filtering, and trying to, you know, take the raw data that that everybody is trying to provide and make some sense out of it. And people on the Internet just, you know, they come to expect that anything they read on the Internet is true. It's just so not so.
Okay, Jim, thanks for the call. Andy, do you want to respond to Jim?
Yeah, well, I think he's right that there's this new type of journalist that's evolving online that some people refer to as a curator, which, you know, you can debate whether or not that's a great term for what we do. But essentially, you know, historically, if you look at journalism, a reporter will synthesize all of this information that they're getting privately and then share it with the public once they know what's going on. But with social media and the Internet today, a lot of that information is already circulating in the public domain, and it can be confusing to sort out, and you don't know who's who to trust and why to trust them and all that. And so I think one of the roles I play is by stepping into this fray and saying, okay, well, let's take a deep breath here for a second and look at all the information that's coming out on this particular topic, and let's sort through it together. And so, you know, it's funny because people often say that tools like Twitter have actually speeded up dissemination, and often leads to rumors. And, you know, while on one hand it's true, it also allows you to slow things down because since it's an interactive medium, you're able to engage in conversations with people there to say, hold on a minute, just because someone says this is true doesn't mean it is. So let's tackle this together.
Are you inhibited, or is the process inhibited at all by the limitation of characters in any given tweet?
You know, I of course you have to communicate in different ways when you have a platform that is terse by nature, but you get used to that fairly quickly. And in fact, I think it teaches people to get to the point. You can't really ramble on Twitter, it's really a good way to get people to focus on the task at hand. And because it's essentially instantaneous, it's almost like having a group of people sitting around a table debating and examining something in real time. And if anything needs to be said in a longer format, you know, you can always go to another platform, another place on the Internet, and say something in a longer form and just share a URL of that. You have plenty of ways to work around that as needed.
So is Twitter the most effective platform then? I mean, compared with Facebook, YouTube, or any of the others?
They're different. They all have different strengths and weaknesses. Twitter is really good for real-time conversation and sorting out eyewitness reports. Facebook is often really good for bringing together groups of experts, eyewitnesses. It wasn't unusual during the Arab Spring for revolutionary groups to form their own spaces on Facebook. And if you could get permission to join these groups, it would give you a closer look at how they worked, how they operated. And then YouTube is an ongoing stream of new footage, sometimes with context, sometimes without it. And so a lot of the raw materials that we end up discussing elsewhere first appear there. So we shouldn't just look at this as a Twitter phenomenon. It's really a social media phenomenon that's happening across platforms, but Twitter is often where the final word comes out.
How much help do you have? I mean, we're talking about the most recent period, the Arab Spring, very, very volatile situation, stuff going on 24/7. Are you by yourself in analyzing all of this material?
For most of the time, it was just me and my Twitter followers. And over the course of about a year, year and a half, over 2,000 people at one point or another volunteered their time or information or skills to me. And so some of them did it on a regular basis. A lot of them did it on a one-off. But there were enough people out there willing to help me translate things and research things that I was able to keep up with a lot of this on my own. At one point, I did have a production assistant who was a native of Saudi Arabia and was extremely well-connected with the regional blogging community and activist community. And so in the early days of Syria, he really helped put a stamp on NPR's coverage of the videos coming out there, because he literally spent his entire time, you know, his 40 hours a week focusing on authenticating videos for Syria. But apart from that one particular task, I've been doing all of this on my own.
But, you know, much of what you were receiving, I'm sure, was it was in Arabic.
Right.
How do you deal with that?
Well, that's really easy, because if something is in Arabic, I share it with my Twitter followers, and they would form teams to translate it. Sometimes if it was really short, people would just send me a tweet with a translation, and I might get 5 or 10 people offering me a translation so I could cross-reference what they're all saying and come to as best of an interpretation as I could get from it. In other cases, if it were a video that might have 5, 10, 15 minutes of translation needed, people would volunteer, and they'd say, okay, let's go over to Google Docs and work on translating this together, and once we figure it out, we're going to close caption the video. And so I had volunteers all over the world who, you know, if I simply asked for help, they would come out of the woodwork and do it. They were more than happy to do it, because these were topics that they cared about, and they knew that they had subject matter expertise that could help in our coverage.
Were you at all surprised by the way all of this was coming together for you?
Well, I was surprised that I was able to do all of this for multiple countries. When in the early days, when it was just Tunisia happening at once, or when Egypt was the sole revolution happening, you know, I was able to keep up with it fairly well on my own. But once the revolution spread to half a dozen other countries, it got to a point that if I didn't have help from my online community followers, it would have been very difficult for me to do justice to any of these storylines. And so I really had to reach out to my community very, very quickly and ask them to help me cover each of these countries. And so different people played different roles for different areas, and it allowed me to keep up in a way that I certainly didn't think was possible before.
Let's go back to the phones, and we'll bring in Max calling from Baden. Max, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. It occurred to me while you're talking about citizen journalism, I thought of the old term stringer. Mm-hmm. Now, in the old days of the old print media, stringers were not regular reporters. They sort of offered their services and their stories, and I don't know how the old newspapers checked these people out, because I can't imagine the old newspapers aren't today, if they're using stringers, they do not take their stuff without doing some investigating or have some trust of them, because they could be practicing some sort of personal propaganda for an agenda, or being paid to practice a propaganda, with an agenda. So I don't know if your guests have thought of this before, but now we have a lot more stringers, since we have phones with video and photographic capabilities. And lastly, you mentioned some deluded souls out there that believe everything they read on the Internet. Well, that's one of the old, I don't know, that's over 100 years ago, somebody said, don't believe everything you read in the newspaper. And I think that's a good thing with the Internet. Know who the source is.
Max, thanks for the call. Well, Andy, that's that goes back to what you were saying earlier with regard to media literacy.
Right, absolutely. You know, whether you're a fan of NPR or Fox News or CNN or whatever it happens to be, I would hope that you're not a consumer of a sole news source. The more informed we are by more diverse sources, the better informed we're going to be, which is why when people follow me on Twitter, I really go out of my way to curate information from a wide range of sources, both mainstream media organizations and people that might be considered citizen journalists or stringers or what have you. Now, stringers still exist. News organizations employ them all over the world. And if you work in the news business, you know that you have to take some of what's being said with a grain of salt. But that's really not that different from when you hire people people in general. You need to figure out whether or not they're going to be a trustworthy source. And some stringers turn out to be great journalists, and others develop, it becomes clear that they have an agenda. So you don't work with that person anymore. And so it, you know, it comes with the territory that you have to sometimes deal with people who have an agenda. But, you know, there are ways of dealing with that. And that's always been the case in journalism, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
And in the world of traditional stringers, it should be pointed out that they are almost always paid. The stringers that you're dealing with, if we can use that term, obviously are not.
Right, yeah. That's why it's one of the reasons why I don't use that particular term to describe them, even though there are some similarities. Ultimately, these are all volunteers.
How is this trend, do you think, influencing mainstream media, if at all?
Well, I think it's become commonplace for news organizations to figure out how to have staff using social media for news gathering. At larger entities such as Reuters or the AP, Wall Street Journal, CNN, all these New York Times, they all have social media teams that work on breaking news with their other breaking news teams to sort through the morass of information that's online to figure out what's newsworthy and what's not. And so I think that's becoming a more common practice. You also see people playing a role as curator, in which they try to capture what's going on through social media and make a coherent narrative out of it. The New York Times, for example, has an excellent blog called The Lead, and I think they do a really good job at parsing through social media and making narratives out of it. But then you also have some of the more outlier stuff that I do, which is, you know, real trying to collaborate with people in real time. You don't see much of that still, but it does happen in fits and starts, because it's not unusual for a journalist who's comfortable on Twitter to ask a question occasionally, and if they're fortunate, they'll get good answers and follow up with people as necessary. I guess what's different is they do it on much more of an ad hoc basis, where I see it as integral to how I practice my craft on a day-to-day basis. And so over time, I think we'll see more people in the news business engaging people online for assistance. But it's going to happen at whatever pace is appropriate, depending on the reporter and the topic.
Is real time always important? I mean, there has to be times when you have to step back from that a little bit as well.
Well, of course. You know, when I say real time, I'm not necessarily saying that it needs to be fully reported on real time, but often it needs to be gathered in real time, because there may be eyewitnesses out there who for a short period of time will be relaying information, and if you don't find them quickly, you might miss them. Social media is so ephemeral that if you're not on top of things, it can be very hard to trace a paper trail of who said what and when. You know, if you just think about how many tweets cross your desk on a daily basis, if you're on Twitter, hitting the rewind button can be rather difficult. And so by having people who specialize in mining social media for information and getting in touch with people as soon after the fact as they can, it helps inform our coverage.
That is Andy Carvin. He is the author of Distant Witness, Social Media, The Arab Spring, and A Journalism Revolution. As I mentioned earlier, Andy's going to be with us tomorrow at 7 o'clock here at Umselet Grand Center. He'll have an evening event, and it should be most interesting. If you're interested in what is going on in this newly emerging world of journalism, you'll want to see Andy. That's part of our St. Louis Public Radio's Kitchen Sink series, 7 o'clock. We have more information on our website. We'll come back and have more questions. We'll want to take more from you and the listening audience. We have some lines open at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. You can also reach us through Twitter and also through Facebook. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with Andy Carvin, NPR social media strategist and, as I've mentioned, the author of Distant Witness, Social Media, The Arab Spring, and A Journalism Revolution. I want to go right back to the phones. Jerry and O'Fallon, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Hi.
I appreciate anything that democratizes reporting, and for events, I think we've reached a point. I mean, if you could only imagine if the Kennedy assassination took place today, I mean, there would be thousands of Zapruder films, you know, that would exist out there. But what I would like to see is getting people more involved with, I guess, the behind the scenes, the real digging, you know, the investigation into you know, even like at a municipal level, who's getting awarded contracts, things like that, that I kind of see as traditional journalism is fading. Those are the kind of important things that do take a lot of work, in some cases a lot of funding, and a lot of training for people to know what to look for. So I guess more of the subtleties as to the decisions that, you know, really, I mean, news tends to gravitate towards events. We always see if there's a large car accident on the evening news, but we don't see the decisions that took place, say, in Jefferson City, our capital, that have a much more profound effect on our lives.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
Comment, Andy?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think there's a huge opportunity in journalism today to really capture and understand what's happening at the state and local level in terms of government and governance. And I think because it's not as sexy as revolutions and national politics and other topics, it often falls through the cracks. But I think one thing that we should really think about is that if you're a news organization and part of your mandate is to cover state and local politics, there's a very good chance that some of your audience is very engaged in these topics. For one reason or another, they might be very passionate about it. They might have some a background in, you know, running databases and or as a researcher or something, and so they're adept at digging into all sorts of interesting morsels of government information. You know, I really think, depending on what the topic is, we need to have journalists who are comfortable going online and saying, I don't know everything about this topic and I need help. I can't cover this without your help, and here's a chance for you to strengthen what we do as a news organization and hopefully strengthen our democracy in the process. And so I think there are all sorts of pressure points within the news gathering process where the public can chime in, and it doesn't have to just be breaking news events. I think for longer term stories that are of equal or greater importance, we should be exploring new ways of tapping into that knowledge as well.
Well, we should, but it goes back to that Pew survey, does it not, where the newsrooms at newspapers are shrinking, and dramatically so. Local television news is 40% chit-chat, weather, and, you know, the rest of it's probably crime news. They really don't seem to want to take on, I'm talking about local TV now, primarily, want to take on the issues of state government and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. You know, it's been a challenge in local broadcast news for a long time. When everyone is concerned about their bottom lines and ad dollars, news organizations often gravitate to, you know, what sells. You know, there's a reason why the phrase, if it bleeds, it leads, exists, because that's been a truism in journalism for a long time. But at the same time, I think there's an appetite for people among the public to learn more about how their government works. You know, if you just take a look at you know, the whole Occupy movement, there's this whole this enormous population of people around the country and around the world that have very strong feelings about economics and economic justice in their communities, and it's there are topics that weren't getting the kind of coverage that they generally deserved. I think there is an appetite, and social media and the internet allows you to really focus your coverage on groups of people who feel who are passionate about different topics and can really work with you on them. And so you can delve into topics in ways that we didn't before. And so I'd like to think that social media is affording us a whole new opportunity to engage the public in creative ways in local investigative journalism. We just have to have the will to do it.
We have an email from John, and you've already responded to what he is concerned about somewhat, but let's give him his response. He asks, what would you say to a local newspaper editor who dismisses social media as unreliable gossip?
I think if you dismiss all social media that way, then you have immediately tied one hand behind your back, because whether you like it or not, news is playing out in real time through social media now that people have the ability to share information so easily. And a lot of it's going to be bunk. We know that. Misinformation spreads all the time. But within that, there are going to be nuggets of truth
that need to be shared. And it's always been the responsibility of news organizations to sift through what's fact and what's fiction. Now we're seeing all of that information being shared publicly, so why would we ignore our prior role in sifting through this stuff and just allow the public to consume potentially misleading information? If I were an editor, I would say it's time for us to wholeheartedly embrace being a part of that conversation, because then we can also re-embrace our role as informing the public better.
We have this Facebook posting from another John who writes, too many citizen journalists put out wrong reports, yet there are no ramifications. If traditional journalists get it wrong, they get sued.
Well, yeah, I mean, some get sued, but that's a minority of the time, because that tends to be, cases of libel and the like. You know, more often than not, when a journalist makes a mistake, it's just an honest mistake. You see that happen all the time in breaking news, especially, I think, with news networks that are 24/7 news networks. They can't have dead air. They have to keep talking and sharing information, and so the likelihood of bad information circulating that way increases dramatically. But, if you watch Twitter, if you while watching a breaking news broadcast at the same time, you'll see both communities grappling with what's true and what's not. The difference is, at least with social media, there is an immediate feedback loop. So if people believe that someone got something wrong, you can let them know very quickly. Whereas the time to resolve those mistakes on air can often take much longer.
How do you deal with someone, one of your contact sources, whatever we wish to call them, who provide information that turns out to be false and perhaps intentionally so? Do you have any kind of a mechanism for dealing with that?
Yeah, you stop working with them. It's as simple as that. If there's someone giving me information that doesn't seem to match what I'm hearing from multiple sources, of course it's going to draw my attention. And, in some cases it means they're actually the only one who got it right. But in some occasions it's because they are sharing something intentionally wrong. But it happens pretty rarely. I think what's much more common is people in the heat of the moment to share something that they haven't thought through completely, because they care about it, they have an emotional response to it. So it's like the classic example of people at a protest saying a million people are there, when in reality it's only 10,000 or maybe 100,000 at best. It's because they want it to be true. And so I think on a day-to-day basis, you have to deal with people who are sincere in their efforts in sharing information. They just don't necessarily have all the facts.
We have a couple of tweets here. We put out a request for questions via Twitter, and we have one response here. A young lady by the name of Tracy, I believe. I only engage with those I know outside of Twitter. We asked her if a Twitter conversation with someone she didn't know has ever transferred into getting to know that person beyond Twitter. She responded, "No, not yet. So far, when someone I do not know engages me, it is hostile and unfriendly."
Well, that's unfortunate to hear. It sounds like they're getting to know the wrong people online. I mean, let's face it, there are a ton of people online who are jerks, but that's life. There are people in this world that you'd rather not spend time with. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who are extremely sincere and generous and want to be part of a greater community. And so you have to invest time in finding who those people are and where those communities are. And, of course, you're always going to have a certain amount of trolls who are trying to ruin it for everyone. But that's why the tools like Facebook and Twitter have block buttons. You can get rid of these bad actors who are trying to interfere in your conversations and focus on the people who want to be constructive. But it takes work. If you really want to have constructive relationships online with people and to learn from other people, it has to be – it's a two-way street. You have to be prepared to give as much as you take in.
Interesting things, as you well know, do happen online. I happened to read a newspaper column in the Washington Post this morning from Kathleen Parker.
Right.
And she was talking about the – did you read that?
Got it on my desktop at this very moment, but I haven't read it yet.
Okay. I'll just advise you and the audience of what it deals with. She's talking about the rape incident and the convictions of two young men yesterday for a rape of a 16-year-old in Steubenville, Ohio. And what dismayed Kathleen Parker was the fact that a lot of this was captured via cell phones and the normal means. And she was concerned about these witnesses were dispassionate observers. They did send this information out, and they sent it to friends and what have you and posted it wherever. But they were not interested enough in what was going on to stop it.
Yeah, I think people need to spend more time thinking about their responsibility. If you see a fight happening, should you get involved or do you pull out your camera and just stare blankly at them? I think we all need to look at our own consciences and think about what are the ramifications of taking one path and not taking the other. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. I mean, there are some times where things need to be documented. If not, we wouldn't have had the Rodney King video, for example, or other videos that have shown beatings and police brutality and the like. But there are times also where I think people are too eager to just have something they've done be posted on YouTube, and they are dispassionate, to use that term that Kathleen Parker used. And I think we all need to have a better awareness of the responsibilities we have in society, both online and offline, and the ramifications of which path we choose and why we've chosen them. So I absolutely sympathize with her concerns, but I also think there are times where it's necessary to bear witness as well. But are we striking the right balance with that? And I can see how one can get the impression that the pendulum is swung too far in one direction.
Can you give me the most dramatic thing that this is an unfair question, I guess, in many ways, after all the tweets and information you handled during the Arab Spring? Was there any one that stands out as being perhaps the most dramatic, or one that impacted you the most?
You know, it's tough to have a single incident. The ones that have been most dramatic tend to be ones that are playing out in real time. And you've, like, for example, some of the fighting that took place against protesters in Tahrir Square, or people caught in the middle of a firefight in Egypt or Syria live streaming what was happening. I mean, those are all extraordinary dramatic moments. I think the ones that impact you the most are the ones that you feel like you've formed some form of connection with for one reason or another. There's a story I tell in the book of a boy in Syria who was gravely injured by shrapnel. His jaw was shot off, and the video was posted sometime after the fact, but it was so extraordinarily upsetting that I felt the need to try to contact people in the region to see if there was anything we could do for this kid. I even managed to pull together a team of volunteer surgeons in Lebanon who were prepared to operate on this boy if we could get him out. Unfortunately, he passed away before any of that could happen. And so, was this individual boy breaking news? Not necessarily, but he was one story, one human being that was emblematic of all the horrors that were happening in Syria. And for a brief moment, it felt like I could at least make a difference in his case. But unfortunately, I couldn't.
Andy Carvin, do we need some ethical guidelines for all of this?
I think we need to be able to discuss these issues in terms of ethics, morals, and everything else that we would generally apply to the media and journalism. Whether those things become rules, though, is a whole other matter. I think if you get to a point where you're saying, in order to be a citizen journalist, you have to meet the following requirements and follow these certain rules, I don't think that's realistic. But I think if we spend a lot of time trying to educate the public on what makes good journalism and what doesn't, and what role they can play in better informing the public, I think we can all benefit from that.
Yeah, it is unrealistic to really think that you can impose any kind of ethical guidelines on people, young people in particular, who are in the middle of a revolution.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, we have to be realistic about our expectations, but what we can do is demand that if people are going to take on the role as citizen journalists, or however you want to define it, they also have a responsibility of being as accurate as possible. And because of social media, we can hold them to account.
30 seconds left. Where is it all taking us, do you think?
Well, I think we're just at the beginning of this. Affordable high-speed internet access through mobile devices is spreading all over the world and becoming more common here in the U.S. as well. And so the intensity of this flow of information from the public is only going to increase, which means it also increases our responsibility in finding people, whether professional journalists or not, to sort through this and making sure that we continue to be as best informed as possible.
You know, I think I saw today, and perhaps I saw it in your book, that there are today 1 billion cell phones in Africa? Is that possible?
It's entirely possible, because there are some parts of the world where cell phone penetration exceeds 100%, because on average, people have more than one phone.
Well, there we are. That'll keep people like you busy for a good long while, Andy
Indeed.
Carvin. Thanks once again for being with us. The book is Distant Witness, Social Media, The Arab Spring, and A Journalism Revolution. Andy will be in St. Louis tomorrow evening for an event right here at the Umzulit Grand Center Community Room. It's part of St. Louis Public Radio's Kitchen Sink series. It's happening at 7 o'clock. Everybody is welcome. We have more information on our website. Looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night, Andy.
Likewise. I'll see you then.
Have a safe trip to St. Louis.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
That is Andy Carvin. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, a discussion about the possibility of creating a multi-million, 7-mile streetcar system running between downtown St. Louis and the Central West End. We'll also have a conversation with St. Louis native Duncan Wall about his first-person experiences with life in the circus, both overseas and here. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.